Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Okay, good morning. It's Sunday, the 12th of October, 2008. That makes this Solder Smoke 93. Let's see, sort of a combination travel log Hamfest report. Just after we recorded Solder Smoke 92, we headed back for the weekly flea at Trastevere, which is what I'm calling it. I'm the only one who calls it that, by the way, so don't try to look it up on the net. It's it's actually the flea market at Porto Portense in the Trastevere neighborhood of Rome. I think I told you guys about Trastevere. It's the kind of wrong side of the river part of town, a kind of bohemian kind of a medieval village. They have this great flea market. Anyway, I've discovered that there are actually useful electronic and workshop items in there amidst all the used handbags and secondhand clothes and decrepit furniture and all that kind of stuff. But there are actually bits of electronica in there. And I've made it my mission to discover them and where appropriate, buy them. So anyway, 2 weeks ago, we all head down to the flea market. We can walk, which is a great advantage in Rome. Parking is not easy here. So if you can walk, you do, and we did. So we got there, and just as we entered it, the flea market, my wife got a brilliant idea. She said, "Let's split up the group here, and you go with Billy, and I'll go with Maria." And so that made a lot of sense, because believe me, our interests in most flea markets are vastly different. So the ladies went off to look at clothes and cosmetics and things like that, and Billy and I headed for the technical part of the show almost instantly. I mean, it was like a miracle. The first batch of technical junk that I looked down at, sitting there, looking at me, and I'm going to turn and pick it up so I have it in my hand, is, I got it here now, it's a thing of beauty. It's a little box, I guess it's about the size of your hand. It's got all the appropriate connectors on it, and it's labeled Pi Antenna Tuner. Pi Antenna Tuner. Excellent. And I looked at this thing, and wow, it's obviously an HF antenna tuner. I've got a picture of it up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog page. So if you want to look at what I'm talking about here as you listen, go ahead. I mean, obviously this will be difficult if you're listening on an iPod, but if you're at home in front of your computer, you might want to call up that website, because you could take a look at the thing. And I've taken a picture of both the outside and the inside. The outside looked great. And of course I had my suspicions about what might lie within. At the moment that I made this discovery, the proprietor was off having a cup of coffee, which, you know, you do. So I had to wait for him to come on back. And I kind of suspected that there wouldn't be a whole lot of other buyers out there at this flea market for a Pi antenna tuner. Eventually the guy comes back and I say, "How much you want for the Pi antenna tuner?" And he said, 15 euros. Which these days, I guess, is about 21 bucks, something like that. Anyway, I said instinctively, in my flea market mode, I said 10, and then I made the standard look like I'm walking away, and he said, "Oh yeah, okay, okay, okay." And I came back. Then he started telling me. He said, do you know what this is? I said, yeah, I know what it is. And he said, are you a ham? I said, yeah. He says, well, me too. Well, sort of. He says, I'm a ham, but I've never had a license. And he said, the government wouldn't give me a license because of my father's politics. Okay. All right. But then I said to him, well, what is this thing? I mean, it looks almost, the outside of the cabinet looks almost commercial. I said, is this a commercial piece of gear? He says, no, I built it. I built it myself. I said, did you build it from a kit? He said, no. He says, this is homebrew. He basically said to me in Italian, this is homebrew. So I said, oh, okay, let's go back to 15. I didn't have the heart to kind of bargain down on a piece of homebrew gear. I didn't care about the license thing too much. If this guy built this thing, well, I'm not going to haggle with him. So anyway, we were back at 15, and he explained to me he built it himself and everything else. Okay, great. Money changed hands. I threw it in the bag. We went and did the rest of the flea market. Got some old Roman coins, some all kinds of other stuff that Billy was looking for. And when I got home, I said, all right, I got to crack this thing open, take a look. You got to see. You know, and I was, you know, skeptical. I said, man, let's see what's inside this thing. Guys, it's beautiful. It's really great. I mean, it's a thing of beauty. It's got these two really nice reduction drive capacitors in there. Very, very high quality. The parts quality are really high. It's got a really, I mean, I've never seen a rotary wafer switch this nice. It's really good. And then the coils are just unbelievably good. They're obviously homebrew, hand wound on these little little formers that he's cut for purpose. And he's got a 10 dB attenuator in there. He's got a built-in SWR meter circuitry. It's really great. Everything's fine. But there's one mystery about it, and I discussed this up on the website page, on the blog page. Well, there were a couple mysteries. First, after he told me that he built it himself, I said to myself, all right, if he built it himself, why did he write on the front of it Pi Antenna Tuner in English? What's up with that? And so when I went back to him, I said, why'd you do it in English? He said, well, you know, that's what we call them. You know, we use the term, we use the English term for this piece of gear, which makes sense. They do. And some of the other switch labels are obviously kind of the abbreviations for Italian terms. So, yeah, okay. Then the other mystery arose when I got home and looked at it, because, you know, if it's a Pi network tuner, you got the coil up there on the top horizontal portion of the Pi, and then you've got the two variable caps to ground. That's it, right? So I expected to find basically that circuitry, but then I noticed something. He's got that first input cap. That first input cap that, you know, should just be from the input connector to ground, and then along the top of the cap, the coil. He's got it floating. He deliberately went in there and has got some, you know, plastic insulators. You know, it takes a lot of it's real easy to just mount one of these things to the cabinet or to the front panel, and that's what he did with the second cap. But the first cap, he's got it floating. And I checked; it is in fact floating. And because it's floating, when you when I put my LC meter across the input terminal and vary that input capacitor, basically nothing happens. So he's got that thing floating, and I think with it floating like that, the capacitor, that input capacitor, isn't even really there electrically. And in essence, this thing is functioning like an L network with the output cap and the coil. The signal goes through the coil, and then output cap to ground, and you got your L network there. Obviously, it's really easy to turn it back into a Pi network. All I have to do is ground the what should be the grounded portion of the input cap, and I could do that. But we'll see. I asked around and sought some ideas about why he would do this. If I see him back at the flea market, I'll ask him. He probably won't remember. When I started asking him about him at the flea market, he told me that he built it a long time ago and had built many antenna tuners subsequent to this project, and so he probably won't remember. But I'll give it a shot. If I see him, I'll ask him. But a real nice piece of work, and wow. I mean, you talk about a flea market success. I haven't used it yet, but I'm going to fire it up. I'm going to use it. I feel compelled to use it. I really like the fact that it's got the SWR meter built in, because you know it makes it's. He's even got connectors for you can use at the output. You can hook up open. He's got connectors for open wire and BNC. So either way, it's good to go. And anyway, it'll be a real. This might actually prompt me to do some more kind of portable and mobile operating. I haven't done much of this because you just start having to lug around the antenna tuner and the SWR meter and all the cables to connect them. Well, now I got it all here in one box, and it's even nicer. It's nice. I like to use a homebrew piece of gear. Obviously, I like to use it better if I homebrewed it. But if I didn't, having a homebrew piece of gear built by somebody else, well, that's almost as good. So anyway, I put this thing back on the bench, and we'll be working on that. Speaking of hamfests, got a nice report. If anybody has any other ideas on why that that input cap would be floating, let me know. Let's see. You'll see on the blogspot, soldersmokeblogspot.com page. There's some comments under the pictures about guys who had some ideas about why that cap would be floated. All right, I guess the fall is sort of another round of the hamfest season in different parts of the world. And I know that 2 weeks ago when I was there at the Flea of Trastevere, I think that was the weekend for the Kempton Park rally in London. I think it was. And Billy and I missed that, obviously being 900 miles to the southeast. But I hope everybody at Kempton Park had a good time. Billy and I always enjoyed that rally. Let's see. We have a report from Belgium on the, it's from Nick Petfar. His call sign, and Nick's a frequent contributor here, M0NJP, and he's now operating out of Belgium. He's ON4NIC. And on the 28th of September, he attended the National Belgian Radio Rally about 60 kilometers south of Brussels. And he gives us a good report on some of the good stuff he picked up. I'll go through it here. The first purchase was at the first stall, end of the line, etc., new stuff. I spotted a 4-amp Variac with built-in digital voltmeter for €35, a bargain. I took this heavy item straight back to the car. I then looked around before ordering a shirt with call signs on and buying a bag of ancient, probably 1920s or older, high-voltage capacitors made by Alter. The ones which look like dark biscuits with a screw hole at each end marked in micro units, i.e. UU, micro 5,000 farads, 5.9 nanofarads. I bought some Loctel valve sockets, which were very expensive at €3.3 each. I have some World War II RAF valves with this end. I purchased an HP function generator 0 to 3.55 megahertz for €50, which I think is a good buy. My homemade one from 1980 uses a chip which gives strange waveform glitches at the peaks. Yeah, Nick, get rid of that. Yeah, got the HP gear now. Fine business. Nick goes on. I watched a demo from a German stallholder of aluminum soldering. It was so impressive, I bought an entire kit, and from another stall, some aluminum sheets. I'm not sure what my intentions are here, but hopefully it won't end up in disaster and fires and burns, as it involves a butane torch and 400 degrees C. Yeah. Well, you know, we all have these urges sometimes. Sometimes you see a piece of gear and it, seems really dangerous, but somehow that increases the allure. Please, Nick, try not to to blow yourself and the house up with this new device. It says here, maybe I can make some fancy chassis for my valve construction, or maybe not. The demo was surely very slick and inspiring. Well, yes, it obviously did the trick with you, Nick. Very good. Nick goes on. I came across a guy selling his own manufactured three-element Yagis for 2 and 6 meters and bought one, even though it was rather expensive. It was only about 2 meters long, and so I thought it would have less neighbor effect than the huge five-element ones. I then purchased a Tentec 6-meter converter and hope now to visit the so-called magic band. Okay, good luck with the magic band, Nick. Every time, I've had very little luck there. I know the people who like that band are very loyal to it, but for me, it's been mostly white noise, so I wish you luck. I hope it works out for you. Nick goes on. One of the times I was walking across the car park towards the entrance from my car, I saw a couple approaching. A normal-looking youngish man with a matching woman and a baby in a pushcart stroller. What single thing that marked this out from the ordinary was that there was a 1970s Tektronix oscilloscope hanging from one of the handles. Judging by the amount of women at this rally, it really could have been for either, or maybe for both, or maybe a christening present for the baby. Okay, Nick, I'm guessing it's for the guy. But Nick did note that there were quite a few XYLs or YLs there at this particular show, and not all of them just seemed to be wives or girlfriends accompanying. So that was interesting. Thanks for that report, Nick, and good luck to all of you in the fall Hamfest season. Send in reports. Our friend Jerry in R5A had some good luck and some bad luck. He attended a series of Hamfests, or one or two, I think, and picked up some good stuff. But then wasn't feeling well. I had to go into the hospital, and was in the hospital for quite some time. He's out now. And Jerry, we hope you're feeling better. And spend some time in the shack. Spend some time with the gear at the workbench, and I think that'll help you on your road to recovery. So best wishes, Jerry. All right. Now, guys, it's time to move into outer space. You'll recall that the last show or the one before, we talked about the Italian brothers from Turin, the Utica Cordiglia brothers. These are the guys up there in Turin who, during the early days of the space age, put together a monitoring station and listened to all kinds of interesting things from the early U.S. and Soviet space programs. I had posted the links to a really excellent TV program about these guys. Unfortunately, soon after we posted it, we didn't post the video. Soon after we announced the link to the YouTube pages, YouTube took it down. Apparently, there was they say that it was some sort of intellectual property thing, but those of you who have seen the X-Files probably know what really happened here, if you know what I'm talking about. K, WD0BDK, also is in a kind of conspiratorial mindset, not thinking that it had anything to do with the aliens among us, but Kay believes that this may have been a Russian plot, and a lot of the work of the Utica Cordiglia brothers was focused on the Russian space program. Also, Kay suspects that the Russians are responsible for having the programs removed from YouTube, and he says that in part it may be because they're mad at us because of our making fun of the woodpecker. All right. So it's either the aliens or the guys with the black helicopters or the Russians, or perhaps it's just some sort of copyright thing. I suppose that's possible. But anyway, those videos were taken down. I imagine they may appear somewhere else. I want a note for the lawyers. I had nothing to do with it. I just just told people about the link. But anyway, about these guys, about the Eureka Cordilla brothers, a lot of controversy. And I posted some links to web pages that discuss the controversy. The controversy centers around whether they in fact intercepted the transmissions of a dying Russian female cosmonaut who apparently was having a really bad reentry experience. And, you know, the brothers have maintained for years that they did intercept this, and they've publicized their recordings. And a lot of very knowledgeable people have come back and said, no, that couldn't have been, it couldn't have happened. And there are all kinds of interesting kind of technical responses explaining why people think that they couldn't have possibly heard what they claim to have heard. I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't dug into it that deeply, so I really haven't made up my mind one way or another. But the guys who are expressing doubt are very knowledgeable and reputable technical experts. But I don't think that's really the point. I think the reason that these brothers were and are so interesting was just because of the enthusiasm that they brought to amateur radio and to the whole space program. The videos about them, all the books and articles about them, really convey this sense of enthusiasm and joy and love for the technology. And this video and a lot of the other stuff, a lot of the other videos and publications out there about them, for me, it was really a good example of kind of the some of the really nice parts of life in Italy, and because the Italians have this great way of bringing real enthusiasm to just about everything they do. And you could see that in the videos about these brothers, just the great fun that they were having, the way they brought in friends and, you know, turned the listening sessions into social occasions, and girlfriends and wives were involved in the project, and it was just great fun. They also filmed back in the late 50s and early 60s a lot of what they were doing, so they created this fantastic archive. And you could see all the old gear and them running around building the antennas. And it was just all great fun. And you know, you got to remember, they like us, were amateurs. And amateurs have a right to get it wrong. That's the great thing. I mean, I'm going to tell you in a few minutes about some of the recent mistakes that I've made here on the technical side. So let's not be too harsh on the Eureka Cordilla brothers. Whether they heard the... whether this particular recording was for real or not, really beside the point. They heard a lot of really interesting things from space. Had a great fun doing it, and I know a lot of listeners in Solder Smoke really enjoyed seeing those videos. I hope they become available again. But anyway, three cheers for the Eureka Cordilla brothers. Bravissimi. That's what I'll say. All right. Speaking of Italian hams, I made a discovery that I want to share with our worldwide listening audience. When I was talking on 20 meters to my local Roman radio amateur friends, I was talking to Giorgio, Italy Zero Yankee Radio, and to Walter, IK Zero ZMH, on our regular 8:30 at night, 20-meter roundtable. I mentioned to them how happy I was with the discovery of my antenna tuner at the FLEA at Trastevere, and they just kind of casually mentioned a couple of kind of technically oriented Italian ham radio magazines that I had never really heard of. And so, the next week when I was going past a kiosk here in central Rome, I found both of them. One of them is called Radio Kit Electronica, and the other one is called CQ Electronica. Guys, these are really very high-quality technical magazines. It's not, you know, it's. I don't mean this as a criticism, but a lot of the American magazines have kind of shifted away from the technical side of the hobby and have become much more oriented towards, you know, operating and I guess what they're calling now, radio sport, that kind of thing. These magazines, almost every single article is technical. They're schematic diagrams, articles on home construction, antenna construction, how to build filters, audio filters, microphone adapters, all really technical stuff. And it's a good reminder of the very high level of technical expertise that exists among Italian radio amateurs, especially Italian radio amateurs from the north, from the Torino and Milan areas, where most of Italian industry is located. So you would expect to find that to be the place where most of the engineers and technicians are also living and working. So three cheers for CQ Electronica and Radio Kit Electronica. I really enjoy the articles because I'm killing two birds. I'm taking care of two birds with one stone here. I'm enjoying the ham radio technical articles, and it helps me improve my Italian while I'm at it. So that's really great. All right. I mentioned before that I was going to let you know about some technical foibles of my own here. There's been some. It's been the best of times and the worst of times. You know how it goes. Things go well, and then you have some problems. Mostly things have been going well here on the technical side. Having built my frequency standard for 30-meter QRSS, I told you this is going to be like a compass that's going to allow me to get back into the 100 hertz wide MEPT, manned experimental propagation transmitter band on 30 meters. I have the frequency standard. So now, without fear, I can wander into the dark forest and make adjustments and improvements on my 30-meter QRSS beacon transmitter. All right. You'll recall that right up until now, I've been just transmitting slow speed CW, 3 seconds per dot, and I guess 9 seconds per dash, really slow. And when it appears on the screens of the radio amateurs who were using Argo and Spectran and other software, it just appears as dots and dashes written, just as if you'd write them on a page, on a piece of paper. Now, that's great, and I was real happy with that, but a number of guys have pointed out that this is really not the best way to do it because, especially when there's a lot of noise on the band, it can be difficult to spot a simple CW signal like that as a transmission and not as noise. They advise that it's better to use an FSK system. And what we're talking about here is the key essentially would, the transmitter would always be in key down. But when the keyer actually, you're always transmitting. It's always putting out RF. But when the key goes down, you just shift the frequency, usually by about 5 hertz, a 5 hertz shift. So that when it appears on the grabber screen, what it looks like is almost like a square wave, but a square wave in which the squares are of different length, indicating dots and dashes. And it makes it a much more recognizable signal. It's recognizable as a transmission and not as just another line of noise. This also helps because one of the problems with ordinary CW is that key clicks or chirp become very, very visible, especially when you're dealing with a system in which, you know, a variation of 1 hertz is visible on these screens. So You recall when I first started doing this, I was dealing with what my signal became known as the Italian tears, because just a few hertz variation in signal on key down made my dashes look droopy on the grabber screens. And guys pointed out that if you're doing FSK keying, you won't get that. So anyway, I decided to make the bold move into the shift into FSK. Ha ha ha. There's a standard little circuit that you use to do this. What most guys do is they take a positive keying voltage from the from whatever keyer board you're using. I'm using the K1EL keyer, and you run that up to a little circuit that's going to add a bit of additional capacitance to your oscillator, and you use a little diode. Most guys use an LED to ground, and when the positive voltage comes up, it hits the diode. It causes the diode to conduct, and when the diode conducts, the additional capacitance is introduced into the circuit, and on key down, the oscillator shifts in frequency a little bit. Take a look at the, if you want to see what I'm talking about, take a look at the blog page, soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Scroll down a bit and you'll see this schematic diagram for what I did, and a screenshot from Johan ON5EX's receiver up in Belgium, where on the morning that I made the change, I was rewarded with almost instant gratification, because I built the circuit, I fired the thing up, I looked up at Johan's screen, and I could see my square waves happily printing out my call sign along the screen. Now, there's one little special feature about my particular circuit is that it's upside down FSK. Most guys choose to have the frequency shift up in frequency by went on key down. I really didn't pay too much attention to that. It didn't matter to me. And it turns out that the way I introduced the capacitance into the circuit causes the frequency to shift down on FSK. This caused some people on the receive side some confusion, because they couldn't read the CW. And I had to go back and tell them, hey, it's upside down. Look along the bottom of the signal, not along the top. And so they got it. I think this gives it a little bit of a distinctive characteristic, and might make it easier for people to realize that they're dealing with my kind of weird upside down FSK signal from Rome. Okay, this is the fun part. I needed a very, very small amount of capacitance to shift this thing. I only wanted it to shift by 5 hertz. Think about it. We're talking about a 5 hertz shift. You can barely tell that there's a shift. If I listen to it on the Drake 2B, I know that the keying is taking place, but it's almost impossible to hear a 5 hertz shift. 5 hertz. Really, really difficult to hear. So, I mean, if you went with a 20 hertz or 25 hertz shift, you're on the grabber screens, you'd be so wide, you'd be kind of antisocial. You'd be taking up a huge chunk of the 100 hertz spectrum that all of us are sharing. So 5 hertz is about the standard. And I tried using little fixed, very small value capacitors. You know, two picofarads, 5 picofarads. And whenever I put them in there, the shift was too wide. So I remembered an old trick that we used, and I'm sure my fellow old-timers will know what I'm talking about here. I decided to use a gimmick, what we used to call a gimmick capacitor. It's basically a homebrew capacitor, and if you wanted to make a capacitor for, like, a very small amount, very low levels, very low value capacitor, you could make one just by taking 2 bits of insulated wire and twisting them together. Don't connect them, of course. The 2 bits of wire form basically the plates of the capacitor. And if you put an LC meter across, you'll see that you're dealing with a very small capacitor, and the capacitor value can be varied by a couple of ways. One, you can just untwist it a bit or tighten it up a bit, and you're varying the value of the capacitor. In my case, I chose to do something different. I had in the junk box a bit of two-conductor wire. Each conductor was wrapped in white insulation, and they were kind of spiraled. Looked kind of like a little DNA configuration there. I think it was the kind of wire that you sometimes got for old kind of earphones. You know, the old transistor radios? Some of them had the little two wires going to the earplug, just sort of in parallel. But I've had some that where it was twisted around. Anyway, I took a bit of this wire. I guess I started out with about 4 or 5 inches of it. And I soldered it in the circuit where I wanted the additional capacitance. And then I used Spectran, and I watched my signal, and I went in and I turned the thing on, and I looked at my own signal on Spectran software, and I could see that with 4 inches of wire, I was getting far too much of a frequency shift. So I took a scissors, and I just literally started trimming down kind of inch by inch, half inch by half inch, quarter inch by quarter inch. Just started chopping off little sections of the 4 inches of wire that were hanging out the rig. And I just trimmed and trimmed and trimmed until I saw on the screen that the signal was varying by the desired 5 hertz. And at that point, I stopped cutting. And it works. You can see on my schematic diagram, you'll see that the gimmick capacitor is kind of portrayed with its own sort of unique schematic symbol. So anyway, I was very pleased, and things worked out well. but then I ran into the technical problems that I alluded to earlier. I wanted to make sure I got everything back in the portion of the band that I want it to be in. I usually hang out around 10140050, about midway through the band. And so I fired up my little frequency standard, turned on the Drake 2B, saw my signal coming out, going into the sound card, and I know that I had my beacon right around the bottom of the band. So I adjusted the frequency of the beacon transmitter to be the desired 50 hertz above the bottom of the band, which would put me in the spot that I wanted to be. I sat back with my cup of coffee. I looked at the screen there of Johann ON5EX. Nothing. And I went through several rounds of adjustment trying to figure out what was going on. And then I realized that I probably had the Drake 2B listening to the wrong sideband. You know what I mean? If you listen to the wrong sideband, when you think that you're moving the frequency up because you're listening to the audio output, you're actually moving it down. So I just flipped the Drake 2B over to the other sideband, repeated the procedure, and there I was. So now I'm, as we speak, my signal is streaming across the grabbers. And if you want to take a look at it, it's probably not crossing the pond this time, but you can look at ON5EX's grabber. You'll see them there. You'll see my signal there. And a fellow in Malta, Stan, 9 Hotel 1, Lima Oscar, has an interesting website up that allows you to check out the various grabbers around the world at different times. So if you guys are trying to take a look at what my signal looks like at various times, go to the 9H1 LO grabber, and you can call up the receiver output from various grabbers around the world at different times. And if you take a look at ON5EX's or or Claudio's Italian grabber, or the grabber that's up in Denmark, you'll be able to see my signal there at different times. It's really interesting to see, for me to see, when my signal starts arriving at these grabbers in the morning at different times. So thanks to all those guys who are working on the grabber projects, and that's my bit of technical, mostly technical happiness with a little bit of frustration thrown in this week, but that goes with the territory. All right, let's see. We have some solder smoke joke. We have a solder smoke joke. A solder smoke joke. This one comes from Bruce, WB8OGK. What's the difference between an introverted geek and an extroverted geek? Answer: the introverted geek looks down at his shoes while he talks to you, but the extroverted geek looks down at your shoes while he talks to you. You know, we're talking about ourselves here, guys. We're joking about ourselves. You know, a friend of mine back in the States once said that at the ham fests, guys really make a mistake by wearing their call sign on their hat or on their on a kind of a badge on their chest. He says they really should put their name tags on the toes of their shoes, because at these ham fests we all spend most of our time looking at the boxes underneath these tables. That's how we could recognize each other. So thanks to Bruce for that. And that's this week's solder smoke joke. Woody, who sent in the last week's jokes, sent me a great page on Murphy's Law, and I'm going to post that on the Solder Smoke blog. And it's got some great jokes about Murphy's Law. When you see the website, be sure to check out the description of the origin of Murphy's Law. Very, very interesting. And it's one of these controversies in which Americans claim to be the origin, and then some of our British cousins come in and claim that no, they were way ahead of us in coming up with this important law. All right, let's see, what do we have next here? Before, this is not really in the category of solder smoke mail, but I asked for help for the son of the guy in the Dominican Republic who was helping me with my antennas for a young man named Joel in the Dominican Republic, and I got some really nice responses. And I think we may have found a way to help Joel out. So the solder smoke community came through on that. And thanks for everybody who sent in emails. I think we'll be able to help this kid and maybe keep him on the path towards education. Who knows? He may become a doctor someday. We'll see. And I'll keep you guys posted on that. Now it's time for
solder smoke mailbag.
Indeed. Yeah, solder smoke mailbag. Scott, KD5NJR, wrote in about the doubts about the Utica Cordilla brothers. We talked about that a bit. Thanks for the email, Scott. Steve, this is an interesting one. Steve, WB6TNL. Steve, who goes by the nickname, he has the motto on all of his emails, Snort Rosin. It turns out that Steve is what I would call a connoisseur of solder smoke. I was not aware, guys, and I'm sure that most of you were not aware until this point, that there are different flavors of solder smoke. I mean, it turns out that solder smoke is sort of like fine wine. I mean, to most of us, it's just solder smoke. But apparently, and Steve was the one who alerted me to this, there are connoisseurs out there who can recognize and appreciate and savor the different aromas produced by different brands of solder. I've been running solder smoke here all these 93 episodes. Mike and I were the inventors of the term solder smoke in the way we use it. And here, all this time, I didn't know that there are connoisseurs out there. For all I know, there may be magazines about, you know, savoring different solder smoke. It's sort of like, you know, it's like the wine experts. It's almost like the guys with the cigar clubs. I didn't know. I had no idea. Steve Snort Rosin, WB6TNL, notes that on special occasions, when working on those special Glowbug vintage tube type radio projects, he likes to make use of, quote, vintage Ursin multi-core, vintage Ursin multi-core solder, because of that special aroma. Gentlemen, we're now joined by the beautiful and talented Maria Patricia.
Hi.
There she is, 8 years old. She comes in, and following her is Tyson the cat. Tyson the cat's following her because he thinks it's breakfast time. Tyson the cat knows there's no hope of approaching me on this subject, so he has to wait for one of the more pet-friendly family members to get up and help him out. Anyway, thanks to Steve, WB6TNL, for alerting us to the wonderful world of the solder smoke connoisseurs. And I think the price of vintage Ursin multi-core solder is likely to rise at this point. Thanks for that, Steve. Paul, WA1MAC, writes that solder smoke has caused him to suffer from a major knack relapse. After 18 years away from the hobby, he started listening to solder smoke and now finds himself working on rigs like the HW8, HQ129X, and old Techscopes. He's also working on his old homebrew gear. Here's an important point. This is really interesting. I really thought this was cool. Paul says that he really needed to find his old copies of SSDRA, of Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. He had lost the old copies. I think he got a copy back, so we don't have to worry about supplying him with one. But it was important for him to get SSDRA because, get this, and I think this is really, really classy. On the old HB gear that he worked on, and on all of his old homebrew gear, most of the stuff that he constructed was straight out of Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. And when he built a particular circuit board out of SSDRA, he wrote the SSDRA page numbers right on the circuit board. He took out a little Sharpie permanent marker and wrote on the board the page number from SSDRA that the circuit came from. Wow, very cool. Three cheers for you, Paul. I have alerted one of the authors of SSDRA to the fact that this was done. I'm not sure if anybody else was doing it this way, but it's a great idea, and it really just, for me, it just emphasizes the importance of that book. It illustrates the importance of that book to many of us home brewers. All right, we got a nice email from our friend in India, Ramakrishnan of U3RDD, one of our Indian listeners. As we noted in the last episode, Ramakrishnan is back in India after a time in Singapore. And, you know, this is another example of the power of solder smoke. Long-term listeners will remember about a year ago, Ramakrishnan, before he left for Singapore, was having real problems with RFI in his shack. There was a power pole transformer, you know, this one very appropriately called a power pig transformer out there that was generating a whole lot of RFI and making Ramakrishnan's radio life pretty much impossible. And, he asked if the solder smoke fraternity could help him out with this problem, if we could do something about it. And I said we'd take a look. We'd see what we could do. Mysteriously, well, perhaps not so mysteriously, a few days later, the offending power pole exploded, and the RFI problems disappeared. Now, I'm not going to get into the details of how this happened or what happened. We'll just have to leave that in the mystery category. But anyway, the problem was taken care of, Ramakrishnan. This week, last episode, I told you that Ramakrishnan, having returned to India, was having great bureaucratic problems with the licensing authorities and the postal authorities in his home country. And apparently the license that was mailed, it was lost, and this was going to cause great delays and knock him off the air. We mentioned the problem, and lo and behold, mere hours after we made mention of it here, the lost license showed up back in Ramakrishnan's mailbox. Once again, the power of the solder smoke is demonstrated. And we're glad you're going to be back on the air, Ramakrishnan. If you have any other problems, let us know. Jim, K9JM, writes about 2N2222 transistors. He's a big fan of 2N2222s, probably a bigger fan than most of us realize. Jim points out that at one point he had, and I'm not kidding here, 60 pounds of 2N2222 transistor. Talk about a bulk purchase. Wow, man. He's trimmed back his holdings of this particular device, and he says he still has a lifetime supply. But wow, I thought I had a lot of them. I never came close to 60 pounds though. That's a lot of there's a lot of rigs in there. So anyway, thanks for sharing that with us, Jim. Another Jim, AL7RV, our old friend. Jim AL7RV writes in that he uses the podcast and podcasts from his home state of Alaska, Alaska News, and he's now in Yuma, Arizona, and he's very happy to stay out in the car while his wife goes shopping and the Solder Smoke podcast and the Alaska News podcasts keep him company. So good to hear from you, Jim, and good luck in your travels. Keep in touch there. We got a nice, very interesting, a technical email from Wes, W7ZOI. Wes was, he CC'd us on a message back to a fellow named Jackson in Indonesia, who was inquiring about, the characteristics of using like plumbing washers as kind of coil forms for toroidal coils. This is, of course, a major feature of the early BitX20 designs, where Farhan and others were seeking to come up with rigs that would not have a lot of hard to find, hard to obtain parts. And toroidal ferrite and powdered iron coil forms can be difficult. They're not the kind of thing that you could just pick up down at the local parts store. And this is not really a big problem for those of us who have access to mail order, but in many parts of the world it would be a showstopper, and I think that's why Farhan and others have very appropriately tried to find ways around this problem. Wes notes that there's nothing wrong with using these things as coil forms. And of course, you're dealing with a permeability of one, but he notes that these kind of coils usually result in low Q problems, and he thinks that using pill bottle designs or pill bottle forms in solenoid form will work out better. And of course, but as Wes points out, that requires some shielding afterwards. So an interesting exchange on that, and thanks for sharing that with us, Wes. Paul, WA5WEP, sent me a really nice message on laser safety because I was asking about whether I should allow Billy to kind of shift from these little red toy lasers into green light lasers. Paul, who obviously knows what he's talking about in this area, says that the issue is not really color, but it's an issue of power out. And I should scrutinize the power out and the safety classification of the lasers in question. So when we return to the flea at Tres Teveri, I will go armed with Paul's email message and do a quick check on the safety of the of the lasers that we may or may not buy. Finally, Terry, G4GHU, sends me a nice email, and he points out that that I am not the only one who was kind of crazy enough to suggest and actually get away with going to the Kennedy Space Center on my honeymoon. He, too, proposed this this as part of the honeymoon itinerary, and his very understanding and his very understanding bride went along with it. So he suggests that we should form some sort of a club of guys who included the Kennedy Space Center on their honeymoon trips. He also found out there some beer of the brand named Excelsior, and this of course brought to mind Gene Shepard. And thanks for sharing that with us, Terry. All right, guys, the family is awake. And we're at the 56-minute point or so here. That brings us to an end of this week's Solder Smoke. I hope everybody in the U.S. has a very happy Columbus Day tomorrow, and I hope everybody has a good next couple of weeks coming up in the at the workbench and at the operating table. 7-3 from Rome.